A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And honestly, it's the kind of question that's been lurking behind every productivity book ever written. He read Getting Things Done years ago, and the core idea hit him hard. David Allen says your brain is terrible at holding on to commitments. Every unresolved thing, big or small, is what he calls an open loop, and it drains you. Daniel's got his own open loop right now. He hasn't bought his sister a birthday present for her daughter. He knows the gift. He's just waiting on an address and the right moment to search for it. And barely a day goes by without him feeling slightly guilty. The nagging is real. But his question is this actually good science? Does externalizing your working memory into a trusted system really work the way Alan claims, or is it just intuitively appealing?
That birthday gift example is perfect because it's so small. It's not a mortgage payment or a medical decision. It's a kid's birthday present. And yet it occupies the same mental real estate day after day, generating the same low-grade guilt. That's exactly what Alan was describing, and it's what makes the GTD promise so seductive.
The promise being, write it down, get it out of your head, and suddenly you have what he calls mind like water. Calm, reflective, ready for anything. Which sounds almost spiritual.
And in an era where we're getting pinged by Slack, email, WhatsApp, Telegram, news alerts, calendar notifications, the cognitive load is relentless. The idea that you could just capture everything and be free of it? That's not just productivity advice anymore, it's practically a mental health intervention.
Or it's a very well-marketed placebo. That's the tension Daniel's pointing at. He felt seen by the book. A lot of people with ADHD especially feel seen by it, but feeling seen and being scientifically validated are two different things.
And that's what we're going to stress test today. What does the actual cognitive science say about open loops, about externalizing memory, about the claim that writing something down frees up your brain? Because some of it holds up beautifully, and some of it is, let's say, creatively interpreted.
We're not here to dunk on David Allen. The man wrote a genuinely influential book. But we are going to take the core claims, put them under a microscope, and figure out which parts you should actually build your life around.
Which parts might be making things worse without you realizing it?
Let's define the terms before we start poking holes in them. An open loop, in GTD language, is any commitment you've made, or even half made, that hasn't been resolved. Could be file taxes, could be buy niece a birthday present, could be decide whether to switch dentists. The point is, your brain keeps a placeholder for it.
That placeholder isn't passive. Alan's claim is that it actively consumes cognitive resources. Your working memory is treating this unresolved thing as live cargo, even when you're doing something completely unrelated. You're making dinner, and part of your brain is still holding the birthday gift.
Which is why the prescription is so simple. Napkin, voice memo, fancy app, doesn't matter. The act of capturing it moves the commitment from your head to a trusted system, and that supposedly frees up the mental bandwidth for actual thinking.
The key word there is trusted. Alan is very specific about this. If you write something down but don't trust that you'll ever look at it again, your brain doesn't let go. The system has to be something you regularly engage with.
The core claim has two parts. 1. Unresolved commitments create cognitive drag. 2. Externalizing them into a system you trust eliminates that drag. And the episode we're really making here is a stress test. We're going to take those claims and run them through what peer-reviewed cognitive science actually says about attention, memory, and cognitive load.
I think the reason this matters right now, beyond Daniel's question, is that GTD has become almost canonical in certain circles. Productivity influencers treat it like settled wisdom. But the science is messier than the book lets on, and some of the messiness has real consequences for how you should actually implement it.
Especially if you've got an ADHD brain. The GTD community has a huge ADHD following, and for good reason. The externalization piece directly compensates for working memory deficits. But that also means the stakes are higher if the method has blind spots. You're not just optimizing a functional system, you're building a prosthetic for something your brain struggles with.
We're going to walk through the evidence, what supports the open loop concept, what complicates it, and where the prescription actually diverges from the science. Some of what Alan got right, he got really right. And some of it is, well, the capture step alone is not the hero of this story.
The review ritual is, but we'll get there.
Let's start with the closest thing the science has to open loops, a finding from 1927 that basically predicted Alan's entire framework by accident. Bluma Zygarnik was a Lithuanian psychologist sitting in a Vienna cafe, and she noticed something odd. Waiters could hold complex orders in their heads perfectly right up until the bill was paid. The moment the transaction closed, the memory evaporated.
Which is either a brilliant observation or a deeply frustrating dining experience, depending on whether you were the waiter or the customer.
But she went back to the lab and tested it systematically. Participants were given a series of tasks. Puzzles, manual dexterity challenges, math problems. Half the tasks they completed, half they were interrupted partway through. Then she asked them to recall what they'd been working on. The interrupted, unfinished tasks were remembered about 90% better than the completed ones.
That's not a subtle nudge, that's a shove.
The mechanism she proposed is what makes this directly relevant to Daniel's birthday gift problem. The brain, she argued, maintains a kind of task-specific tension when something is left unresolved. It's not just that you remember it, it's that your mind stays latched onto it. Completion releases the tension, the loop closes.
The feeling Daniel described, barely a day goes by without the gift popping into his head, that's not a character flaw. It's a 1927 cognitive phenomenon with a name.
And you can see why GTD advocates love citing this. It seems to validate the entire premise. Unfinished business occupies mental real estate. Externalize it, and you're essentially tricking your brain into releasing the tension.
You said, seems to validate. I'm hearing a but.
Modern replications of the Zygarnik effect have found it's real, but significantly weaker and more context-dependent than the original study suggested. It shows up reliably when the task is personally important, when there's time pressure, or when the interruption feels like a genuine failure rather than just a pause. But for low-stakes tasks or tasks where the participant doesn't care about the outcome, the effect shrinks or disappears.
The waiter remembers your unpaid steak because there's a social and professional consequence to forgetting it. The birthday gift nags at Daniel because he cares about his niece and feels the social weight of being late. But buy more paper towels probably doesn't generate the same cognitive tension.
And that's actually a useful refinement of Alan's model. He treats all open loops as roughly equivalent in their cognitive weight. The science suggests they're not. Your brain is making triage decisions based on emotional salience and perceived consequence. The loop that keeps you up at night is the one that matters to you.
Which means the blanket advice to capture everything might be overkill. Some things your brain is perfectly happy to let drift.
Let me give you the other side of this, because there's a second mechanism that supports externalization even when the Zygarnik effect is weak. This is cognitive load theory, developed by John Sweller in 1988. The core finding is that working memory has a hard capacity limit, and when you exceed it, everything degrades.
The magic number used to be 7, right? 7 plus or minus 2.
That was George Miller's famous 1956 paper. But Nelson Cowan's work in 2001 revised that down dramatically. The real capacity of working memory is closer to 4 chunks. That's it. Not 4 complex ideas, 4 discrete items. A phone number without the area code. 3 open loops and a grocery item.
If I'm holding the birthday gift, a word deadline, a question about my taxes, and what time the pharmacy closes, I'm already at capacity. Anything else that comes in pushes something out.
Or degrades the quality of your processing across all of them. This is where externalizing becomes powerful, and it's not just about feeling less anxious. When you write something down, you're reducing what Sweller called intrinsic cognitive load. The mental effort required just to hold information. That frees up processing resources for actual thinking. For problem solving, for creative work, for being present in a conversation.
Even if the Zygarnik effect is weaker than advertised, cognitive load theory gives you a completely separate reason to externalize. It's not just about closing emotional loops. It's about not overwhelming a system that can only hold 4 things at once.
This is where the ADHD connection becomes really important. Daniel mentioned he has ADHD, and a 2020 meta-analysis in Neuropsychology Review looked at working memory deficits specifically in ADHD populations. The effect size for spatial working memory was D equals negative 0.85. That's a large effect. Verbal working memory showed consistent deficits too. These aren't marginal differences.
The 4-chunk limit for a neurotypical brain might be a 2-chunk limit for someone with ADHD. And if you're trying to run a life on 2 chunks, externalization stops being a productivity hack and becomes essential infrastructure.
That's exactly how I'd frame it. GTD's capture habit directly compensates for a documented neurological deficit. It's not about being more productive in some aspirational sense. It's about offloading demands onto an external system because the internal system cannot handle the load.
This brings us to the counterpoint you were hinting at earlier. The external system has to actually work.
This is where the science takes a turn that GTD purists don't always love. There's research on what gets called productivity theater. The act of writing things down, making lists, color-coding notebooks, and feeling productive without actually reducing cognitive load. If you capture something but don't have a reliable review ritual, your brain learns that the capture is meaningless. The system isn't trusted, so the loop stays open.
You've just added noise. Now you've got the original open loop plus a list of 50 other captured items that you feel vaguely guilty about not reviewing.
Studies on this are pretty consistent. Merely externalizing without a structured review process doesn't reduce anxiety. In some cases, it increases it because the list becomes a visible monument to everything you haven't done. The capture step alone is not the intervention. The intervention is capture plus review. Alan knew this. He built the weekly review into GTD for exactly this reason. But the popular understanding of the method often drops the review and keeps the capture.
Which is like buying a filing cabinet and never opening the drawers. You've just relocated the mess.
The knock-on effect are weirder than just a messy notebook. There's a whole body of research on what happens to your brain when you outsource memory. Risco and Gilbert published a big review on cognitive offloading in 2016, and the headline finding is uncomfortable. Yes, externalizing reduces the immediate load on working memory. We just covered why that matters. But it also reduces what they call depth of encoding. You don't process the information as thoroughly when you know it's stored elsewhere.
The act of writing it down changes how much you actually think about it in the moment.
And the most famous demonstration of this is the Google effect. Sparrow and colleagues in 2011 had participants type trivia statements into a computer. Half were told the computer would save everything. Half were told it would be erased. Then they tested recall. The people who thought they'd have access later remembered significantly less, even when the saved information was right there. The mere expectation of future access changed how deeply they encoded it.
Which means David Allen's napkin has a hidden cost. You capture the thought, your brain goes handled, and you don't actually engage with it. If you never circle back, you've effectively deleted it from your own memory, while also not doing anything about it.
That's where capture fatigue sets in. Allen says capture anything that has your attention. But the science suggests indiscriminate capture without triage creates exactly the problem it's supposed to solve. You end up with a cluttered external system that itself becomes a source of anxiety. Now you're not just stressed about the birthday gift, you're stressed about the 47 items in your inbox that you captured and never processed.
The capture step is not the hero, the review ritual is.
This is where GTD's weekly review is actually the most scientifically grounded part of the whole method, even though it gets the least attention in popular summaries. There's a research tradition around implementation intentions, Peter Goldwitzer's work starting in the late 1990s. The finding is remarkably consistent across dozens of studies. When you specify exactly when and where you'll do something, follow-through increases by 2 to 3 times compared to a vague intention.
Give me the concrete example.
A 2001 study looked at exercise. People who formed the specific plan, I will exercise at 7 a.m. in my living room, were about 3 times more likely to actually do it than people who said, I will exercise more. Same desire, same goal, completely different outcome, just from specifying the when and where. The weekly review is where you create those implementation intentions. You're not just reviewing a list, you're converting open loops into concrete next actions with a time and a place.
The review isn't maintenance. It's the actual engine.
And this connects to why bullet journaling, Ryder Carroll's method, has an edge that GTD often misses. Bullet journaling also emphasizes externalization, but it adds migration. At the end of each month, you actively rewrite unfinished tasks into the new month. You're forced to re-engage with each one and decide, does this still matter? The act of rewriting strengthens the memory trace.
Which is the opposite of the Google effect. Instead of offloading and forgetting, you're re-encoding.
Robert Bjork at UCLA called this desirable difficulties back in 1994. The idea is that some friction in learning and memory is actually productive. When you have to work a little to retrieve or re-engage with information, the memory trace gets stronger. Migration is a desirable difficulty. Capture without review is just offloading into a void.
The bullet journal people are accidentally doing spaced repetition on their own to-do lists.
And for ADHD brains specifically, there's another layer here that's worth naming. GTD's next action principle defines the very next physical step, maps directly onto what researchers call task decomposition for executive dysfunction. A 2018 study in the Journal of Attention Disorders found that when adults with ADHD broke tasks into microsteps, their completion rate improved by about 40%. Not the project, not the outcome, the next physical action. Open laptop rather than write report.
Which is Ellen's exact language. What's the next action? Not what's the project. So that part of GTD is not just good advice. It's a direct compensation for a documented executive function deficit.
It's probably the single most evidence-backed piece of the entire method. If you take nothing else from GTD, take the next action question.
You mentioned a dark side earlier. What's the cost of doing all of this well?
This is the part that doesn't get talked about in productivity circles. A 2022 longitudinal study in memory and cognition tracked people over 12 months and found something troubling. Heavy users of digital reminders showed a measurable decline in prospective memory, the ability to remember to do things in the future without external cues. The more they relied on their phones, the worse their unaided recall became.
The system becomes a crutch, and the muscle atrophies.
Cognitive prosthesis dependence. That's what the researchers called it. And it makes intuitive sense. If you never practice remembering, you get worse at remembering. The question is whether that trade-off is worth it. For someone with ADHD, the answer might be yes. The prosthetic is filling a genuine gap. But for someone with typical working memory, you might be trading short-term relief for long-term decline.
Which means the optimal approach isn't capture everything. It's capture the things that exceed your capacity, and let your brain handle the rest. Use the system. Don't become the system's dependent. If we're extracting the practical lessons from all of this, I think the first one is almost a correction to how GTD is popularly understood. Capture is necessary, but not sufficient. The science says the magic isn't in writing things down. It's in what happens after.
The review ritual, and specifically converting those captures into implementation intentions. Goldwitzer's research shows you need the when and the where. Buy niece's birthday gift Saturday morning after coffee is a different creature entirely from buy birthday gift. One is a plan, the other is a wish that happens to be written down.
Which means Daniel's open loop about the birthday present won't actually close just because he wrote it on a list. It closes when he schedules the search for the address and the purchase into a specific time slot. The capture was step one. Step two is the implementation intention.
Second takeaway. And this one is especially for the ADHD brains listening. The next action principle is the most evidence-backed part of GTD, full stop. That 2018 study found a 40% improvement in task completion just from breaking things into micro steps, so use it aggressively. Don't write, plan birthday party, write text, Sarah for the guest list. Define the physical next move, not the project outcome.
If you're not sure what the next action is, that's itself a next action. Figure out the next step for the insurance paperwork is a legitimate item. The point is to stop letting the project masquerade as a task.
Third takeaway, beware of capture fatigue. The science on cognitive offloading suggests that indiscriminate capture creates a cluttered system that generates its own anxiety. Set a limit on your inbox, physical or digital, and force yourself to triage before adding more. The goal is a lean system, not a comprehensive archive of every fleeting thought you've ever had.
A capture habit without a triage habit is just hoarding with better branding.
The fourth one is uncomfortable but important. Periodically test your prospective memory. If you cannot remember a single task without checking your system, you may be over-offloading. that 2022 longitudinal study showed measurable decline in people who relied entirely on digital reminders. Practice brain, only recall for low-stakes items. What do you need from the grocery store? What's one thing you want to do this weekend? Keep the muscle alive.
The optimized GTD practice isn't capture everything and trust the system. It's capture what exceeds your capacity, review it regularly, convert it into specific next actions with a time and a place, and let your brain handle the rest. The system is a prosthetic, not a replacement.
That brings us to a question I don't think we can fully answer yet, but it's worth sitting with. AI assistants are getting proactive. They don't just wait for you to ask, they ping you before you even realize you've forgotten something. You haven't bought the birthday gift. Want me to find the address? At that point, we're not just outsourcing memory, we're outsourcing the review step itself.
Which is where cognitive autonomy starts to feel like a real concern. If the system not only holds your open loops, but also decides when to surface them, what's left for you to do? You're not reviewing your commitments, you're just responding to nudges. That's a fundamentally different relationship to your own intentions.
The 2022 prospective memory study we mentioned. That decline happened with passive digital reminders. Proactive AI that anticipates your needs is a whole other magnitude of offloading. The question isn't whether it's convenient. It's whether convenience at that level erodes something we should want to keep.
I think the birthday gift example actually points to the answer. Daniel's open loop isn't just a memory failure. It's tangled up with care, with guilt, with the relationship itself. Some loops are open because they matter. Outsourcing the closure to an AI might close the task, but miss the point.
Here's where I land. GTD is not bad science. It's incomplete science. The intuition that open loops drain you has genuine backing. Zeigarnik, cognitive load theory, the ADHD working memory research. But the implementation needs to be informed by what we actually know about memory, attention, and executive function. Capture everything is oversold. Review everything is where the evidence lives.
Maybe the final tweak is this. Let some loops stay open on purpose. Not the birthday gift, buy the gift, Daniel. But the small stuff? Let your brain practice holding it. The goal isn't mine like water. The goal is a mind that knows what's worth holding on to.
If this episode helped you think differently about your own open loops, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who's drowning in uncaptured thoughts. We'd appreciate it.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go review my capture inbox. It's been a week. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, Mongolian herdsmen used a specific knot called the camel hitch for securing loads to pack animals. When tied correctly in dry horsehair rope, the knot produced an audible creak under tension, a pitch that experienced herders could read as a warning before the rope snapped.
I don't know what to do with that.
Neither do I.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.